You are listening to the Beyond the Jargon podcast on CFUV 101.9 FM. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge with respect the Lekwungen-speaking peoples on whose traditional territory the university and CFUV stands, and the Songhees, Esquimalt, and Wasanish peoples whose historical relationships with the land continue to this day. I'm a guest on this land, and I'm extremely grateful for the experiences and the life it has given me while I've been here. Welcome to the show. My name is Sam Kaiser. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm a master's student studying music technology in the final semester of my studies. My research is mainly focused on the implications of the growing popularity of immersive audio formats on popular music. This is the third episode of the 10th season, and I'm super excited to get right into it. For any new listeners, here's a quick little rundown of what we do on the show. Beyond the Jargon exists to give a platform to graduate students at UVic so they can discuss their research in an accessible and non-formal way. I'll be interviewing graduate students from various faculties at different points in their academic careers, asking them about their research topics, their experiences as grad students, and what their future plans may be. Today's guest is Tara Cooper. Tara is a second-year master's student in the Department of Psychology, specifically in lifespan health and development.
My name is Tara, Tara Cooper. I'm in the Department of Psychology in lifespan health and development.
And you're in your second year?
Second year master's,
yes. Awesome. So what brought you to UVic or Victoria, and where are you coming from before this?
So I did start my undergrad at UVic, and I chose UVic originally because it's just, Victoria is such a beautiful city. I really enjoy it. I enjoy it for the biking too. Like, my plan's always been to kind of use biking is my main transportation, so it's a great city for that. The campus is really cute. It's just like a ring and everything just kind of goes inside. I understand it. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to stay close to my family. Most of my family lives on the island now, and so staying close to family, being able to see them on weekends, yeah, spending time meant a lot to me, so that's why I chose UVic.
And you're from Victoria, or you're from
I'm from
Coast?
Toronto.
From Toronto, okay,
yeah,
great.
So I grew up in Toronto, and I finished high school, the last 2 years of high school, on the island, and I've just been here ever since. So it's going on 11 years now that I've been
Amazing.
Here.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is a great place. I was also in Ontario for a while. I did my undergrad at Queen's.
Oh, nice.
So I also kind of came from there to here. And
yeah.
I do also really enjoy Victoria, especially in comparison in some ways.
It's different vibes.
Different vibes.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's not... The weather's a lot more mild, which is nice.
It's a different kind of cold, though. Like,
totally.
When I first
it's a
came
wet
out,
cold.
Yeah, it's like a to the bone. Like, growing up in Ontario, it's like you'd go outside in Toronto in the winter, and if your hair wasn't like completely dry, like, you're going to get icicles. And it's
For
not
sure.
like that here, but it's like a different kind of damp cold in
damp
the winter.
Yeah. Wind is so cold.
Yeah.
Was there anything about the program specifically at UVic that brought to your attention? I think we can kind of talk about this question a little bit differently, too. Like, what made you stay at UVic for your graduate degree, too?
Right. Yeah. So, what made me come back? Well, of course, is just like the location is something I really wanted, but the reputation that the Department of Psychology has in aging research is what brought me back, and the opportunity to collaborate with the clinical program. And there's also an Institute for Aging and Lifelong Health that's associated with the university. And so all those things, given my interest in aging research, was what brought me back to UVic.
Let's dial it back a little bit. We'll get into your research a little bit more later.
Sure, yeah.
But I was curious about the application procedure for your program. It's a specific program within the Department of Psychology, right?
Yes.
So that's lifespan and health?
Yeah, lifespan, health, and development.
Lifespan, health, and development.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Great. So were there any like interesting prerequisites or associated activities with applying to this specific program?
Yeah, prerequisites... Because it's more of like a research-based program, the most important prerequisite that I needed was just evidence that I enjoyed or participated in research.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't necessarily have to be an honors thesis in my undergrad, but some sort of like self-directed research project was a prerequisite. And then in terms of the application process, it's pretty standard. Like, it was, you know, a letter of intent, transcripts, letters of recommendation. The part that was the most challenging was, in addition to the application, I decided to apply for federal funding so that in my application I could say that I had applied and that I'm hoping to bring funding with me, because I'd been someone advised me that I should do that as to kind of better my chances of getting in. And that process was really hard, because you basically have to come up with, there's this these three agencies at the federal level, and they fund research in Canada. And master students can apply for it, and PhD students and postdocs can apply for it. And the application process is pretty rigorous. You have to come up with a proposal for research, and then there's a CV that you have to put together through this really, like, antiquated portal that they have that's just, like, doesn't really work that great. Okay. It's, like, just, you know, you have to remember a number and then put it into this other website. And that was a hard process, because you basically have to come up with a proposal for research. And the point is that you can demonstrate that you can think like a researcher.
For sure.
That you can put together something that could potentially work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not that easy to do, especially when you have a couple months to put it together. So that was the hardest part of applying to grad school, but it was a good experience.
For sure. And this was, I always get them mixed up, or I maybe just don't know all of them. There's CERT grants, there's NSERT grants, and then there's another one, which I don't know.
There's a CIHR.
CIHR.
Which is like the health kind
of. So that was the one that you applied for.
I applied. So I've applied for all three at this point.
Okay.
I started with NSERC because my original, so coming into my master's, I had a proposal that kind of fit more in the, it was kind of more about like neurophysiology and mm-hmm. how you could measure pupillary diameter to correlate it to attention and see how that relates to cognitive decline. And so kind of like fit into this natural sciences kind of area.
Yeah, because NSERC is natural sciences and engineering.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so it kind of fit into that area. So I applied for that one. And then I applied for CIHR last year. And then I applied for CIHR this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and just so people, if people don't know, CIHR is Social Sciences and Humanities, I believe.
Yes.
And then CIHR is, do you know what?
Canadian Institute for Health Research.
Okay, so it's really just focused in on health. So,
yeah.
So also like in medicine, I suppose, people might be applying for these things, but more in the research category.
Exactly, cool. Yeah. So very medicine-based on like, how do we improve our healthcare systems? How can we improve the delivery of healthcare? Like diagnosis, that kind of stuff, screening, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, amazing. I messed up the three because I don't think I'd ever heard of that third one.
Yeah.
I'd heard of NSERC grants and CIHR grants because we're often encouraged to apply for these things even as we start our studies, right?
Yes,
like
exactly.
I'm sure you've heard that. And we can maybe talk about this too. You're wanting to start a podcast, or you're in the process of starting a podcast.
That's
at CFUV
true.
About this sort of process. Do you want to kind of talk about that and what inspired you to do that as well?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. So over the summer, I was just kind of thinking about ways that I could contribute back to my community and share my experiences. I like to follow people on YouTube who are on different career paths and watching them accomplish their goals. And it's inspiring to me. And the advice that they have to give is always helpful. And so I was thinking, like, how could I do something like that? And it came to me that maybe a podcast would be a different medium that I could share that kind of information. There's stuff that you can find online, like blog kind of based. There's videos. And I kind of scoured like Spotify to see what there was, you know, in the audio medium, and there wasn't very much. There was one podcast, but I thought that I could contribute a little bit more. So yeah, the idea is that, and I got a grant for it, so it's not just an idea anymore. It's have to
happening.
Do it.
Yeah,
I just gotta, it's happening. I'll record my first episode during reading break.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the idea is that I want to show people, first of all, that you can start anywhere and end up in grad school. I want to share exciting research that's going on right now in the Department of Psychology. So give people that kind of educational piece if they're interested in that. And then I want to give people advice on different aspects of grad school, things that I hadn't really thought of that might help them make their decisions, like things like I want to touch on funding. I want to touch on finding supervisors, the interview process. I want to bring perspectives from groups like parents who are in grad school and like what it's like to be a parent and be in grad school. If you're an international student, what that's like acclimatizing to a new city and mm-hmm. like that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for a lot of different topics, but right now, I have a plan for five. So
Five episodes,
getting started with that.
And five interviews?
Five interviews. Great. Yeah.
And so there's kind of like a focus as well for each one?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to try to make it a kind of season-based, like there's a general topic. And I think the first five episodes kind of touch on like getting into grad school. So all of the different processes that come with getting into grad school, like tri-council funding and that kind of
for
stuff.
For sure. Yeah, because it is difficult too, like just wanting to go to grad school, but then feeling daunted by like all of the associated finances and then like thinking I'm going to be a full-time grad student. Like I probably won't have time to work or I won't have time to work very much. So exactly. I have to think about alternate avenues for income for myself, but also for my research.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a really overwhelming process and it's a commitment to like you're committing the next, at least the next 2 years of your life.
For sure.
If not like even seven. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a pretty big choice to make.
Of course, yeah. It sounds like a great podcast.
Thanks.
I mean, it sounds like it's a great idea, especially for Canadian students, because the Canadian process is different as well, right?
Yeah.
And we talk about these grants, like SHRC grants, NSERC grants, CIHR grants.
Yeah.
We know them because we hear about them, but I had never heard of these things in my undergrad, in my high school, like just thinking about these things that just come up and suddenly people know about them and you have to kind of catch up. So it'd be a great resource, it sounds like. And talking about just like the medium, I think podcasts are great for learning because you're able to do other things while you listen. I find like watching YouTube videos, reading blogs and things, you have to be really engaged and listening all the time or listening and watching or reading. But I like passively listening to podcasts a lot of the time. And I feel like I learn a lot more in some ways. And I also feel a lot more productive in some ways too. So I think, there's definitely room for this podcast, which I think is a great idea.
Totally. Yeah. I've almost like, you know, slice my finger watching something on the TV while I'm cooking, but that doesn't happen when I listen to podcasts.
No.
I'm very focused. Like I could do both things. There's something to be said about like the coupling of like the medium and you have to keep your eyes on it. And as opposed to like audio, you can just like kind of wander around.
For sure. And I think that's also why podcasts are so popular these days too, because we're busy people. Everyone's busy. So it's
easier to multitask with podcasts.
For sure. Totally. Just throw some headphones on and vacuum, do my chores. I always do my chores when I listen
to podcasts.
Me
too. Laundry. Sure. Meal prep. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to talking about your research a little bit. If you could sum up your research goals, your individual research goals, or maybe also your cohort's goals, the program goals, in one sentence, I know that's a tough ask, what would it be?
In one sentence?
You could take a couple if you need.
Okay. No, I think I can do it.
Okay,
I think
sure.
you can do it.
Sounds
okay.
good.
So my goal with my research ultimately is to help people live healthy lives for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So my focus right now is cognitively healthy lives for as long as possible. So trying to extend that health span for as long as possible before we all die.
Mm-hmm. So what made you interested in this sort of topic?
I'd have to say a lot of it is driven by my personal experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with my grandparents in high school. And as an only child, I've spent a lot of my time with my parents and their friends. And they're all aging. And so there's something kind of like personal there where I want to be able to help and find solutions and help them live healthy lives for as long as possible. And my grandparents... My grandmother had a dementia, and so watching that happen for her was really hard, obviously, as many people probably know. But it also inspired a lot of curiosity in me. Like, as I started learning about psychology and about the brain and the, structure, function, relationships, thinking about how the brain is kind of like the basis of our behavior and why we do things the way we do, why we think the way we think, and also how our lifestyles and the experiences that we have over the course of our life might shape how we are as we age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like my grandmother was a really active person and kind of understanding that riddle, like, okay, so why is it that this was the outcome when the life's experiences and lifestyle, your lifespan was pretty healthy?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a riddle that I'm, interested in solving, a puzzle that's, you know, kind of fun to think about, try to figure out, like, what are the pieces that make this happen?
For sure. So you mentioned, like, cognitive health to extend the lifespan or to kind of just keep an active and healthy life in many ways.
Yeah.
So it's keeping your brain healthy is essentially what that means.
Essentially.
Right? Yeah. So there are, I'm assuming the things that you study are like certain factors that seem like they might not affect your brain health, but might in some ways. Like your grandmother lived a very active, healthy life. So it doesn't point to this happening, right? What are some of those factors maybe if you're able to share, like, things that you've come across in your research?
Yeah, well, I'm still learning all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But some of the stuff that I'm focusing on as factors are, like, social determinants. So I'm not in a biology-based program. I don't have that background. So those mm-hmm. are the questions that I can't really answer or ask.
Sure.
So when it comes to, like, genetics or, like, cell mechanisms, mm-hmm. that's for a different department.
Sure. Yeah,
sure. But, like, for me, like, my perspective is the social determinants, so including, like, physical exercise, but things like social interactions, education, occupation, those types of lifestyle behaviors or lifestyles that result in kind of similar behaviors towards your health mm-hmm. and similar behaviors in terms of engaging you cognitively and how that might extend the amount of time that you have with a healthy cognitive frame or with a healthy body, physical body, because the two are really related. Like you said, it comes down to brain health and mm-hmm. physical health and brain health go hand in hand. Cognitive health and brain health go hand in hand. And so it's kind of, all of these really complicated pieces, trying to understand the role of mental health in cognitive decline. Like, how does depression relate to having or your onset of cognitive decline? Does the timing of that depression make a difference? Mm-hmm. Like, when it happens in your life, things like post-traumatic stress as well, or just trauma in general, is it like an underlying risk factor for mm-hmm. earlier cognitive decline? Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think about these things, I guess, like, in terms of, you hear, like, being social is such a key thing in, like, being healthy. But I guess when I think about those things, I think it's just, like, it makes you feel better to be social. Like, that's the necessity. But I guess, and I'm sure, like you're saying, these studies show that it actually has an impact on your brain. Being social, being active, talking to people, it actually changes the way your brain works.
Totally.
And pushes back the decline in some ways, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm interested in, is that kind of resilience. Like, mm-hmm. how do you continue to have, like, this positive outcome despite the fact that you're starting to face adversities.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, a really interesting study that looked at drinking mm-hmm. and its relationship to your cognitive health, and kind of, like, you would think that, you know, drinking is negative,
mm-hmm.
but it is when you're drinking too much. But people who drink socially, there's actually, like, a protective effect.
Mm.
And that's because, it's probably because you're socializing with people.
Yeah, you're in a social environment.
Yeah, like, you're going out, you're maintaining social relationships, you're staying active, and the drinking is just, like, a proxy kind mm-hmm. of, like, of that behavior that's really driving the relationship.
For sure. So it's not really the drinking.
It's the
fact that you're with people.
Exactly. I mean, there's research that's shown that, like, having a glass of wine a day, like, has some sort of protective cardiovascular effect.
Sure.
But there's also, like, the social aspect of it. That's
totally.
Like, you know, like, you probably know people who are social drinkers as opposed to, like, have a problem with drinking.
For sure.
And yeah, it's kind of taps into that kind of lifestyle aspect of drinking and social drinking, recreational drinking, and what it means for your relationships or how often you interact with other people. And yeah,
I guess I never really thought about that either.
Yeah, like, it's kind of like that nuance, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, well, it's not all bad, it's not all good. There's, like, a sweet spot in all of these different kind of categories of our behavior.
Be beneficial in some ways, like, very beneficial in some ways, even if they're detrimental in other ways.
Totally.
To some degree, I guess it's just the balance, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So in your, like, individual research, like, your graduating work, what is your primary focus? Is it these social determinants?
Yeah. It's these social determinants. And I'm kind of applying it to the context of ADHD. Mm. And so there's a lot of people, and this was my Shirk application last year, was about how people with ADHD, and this is at the group level. I'm not saying like individual, if you have ADHD, you're at a higher risk for dementia, but
sure.
There's research that's showing like at the group level, they seem to have a earlier onset of dementia and a higher risk. And so my master's thesis is trying to kind of explain that in terms of the lifestyles that come with having ADHD, especially if it's untreated. Mm-hmm. And that includes like difficulty with education, having trouble holding jobs, having trouble with social relationships. And so using all of those different factors that piece together somebody's life, like how can that make an impact on somebody's risk for dementia. Mm-hmm. And because those things happen more frequently in ADHD, I'm trying to use ADHD as like a case in which I can study that.
For sure. Sort of like a control. All the people that you're studying have ADHD.
Yeah.
So you're able to see like if there's any brain deterioration, I guess is a word to use?
Yeah.
Is that a word that's okay?
Yeah, totally.
Sure. And then examining these social determinants that you're talking about.
Yeah, because these social determinants, like there's kind of a characteristic that comes with ADHD. I can kind of create a group of people with ADHD sure. that probably have similar social characteristics and compare it to the group without ADHD and see like, do those characteristics accompany an earlier or a higher risk for dementia.
Mm-hmm. Again, like I just feel like I'm rethinking a lot of these things that prior perception of people with ADHD, for example, too, like growing up, like in high school and things, like there's a few kids in your class or whatever in your grade who have ADHD maybe, and they're just very hyper, always engaged in some way.
Yeah.
Or can be at least. So I guess like my misconception there is that people with ADHD tend to be more social, but that might be the total opposite because they become more isolated because of the way they experience things, maybe become more burned out by social interactions as well.
Possibly, yeah. It's like the reason why I think it's an interesting group to study is because I'm studying aging, like the people who are above 65 today mm-hmm. and who meet a diagnosis for ADHD, when they were kids, that diagnosis didn't exist.
Of course, yeah.
And so it's very likely that a lot of them never got treated, like they were like the problem kid or mm-hmm. something, right? Mm-hmm. And because ADHD is like considered neurodevelopmental, you can assume it's had effect on the person's life throughout their life. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of like, yeah, this just enduring characteristic of the person that might have a relationship with how they age. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I like about the theory that I'm working from is that it's not deterministic. Like I'm not looking at it from the perspective that, you know, because you have ADHD, there's like, you know, because of that, all of these things accompany it and mm-hmm. it results in this higher risk for dementia. What I'm looking at is like, you could have ADHD and there's variability in like what your outcomes are. Mm-hmm. And let's see whether or not people who have ADHD and whose characteristics are, you know, they've achieved more educationally or have gone further in their occupations or have maintained really good social relationships, it hasn't been as impairing. If that might be an possible outcome that relates to better cognitive outcomes later in life, mm-hmm. Because all of those things can be modified. Like I just saw the other day, there's this program, it's like a high school experiential program. It's a private school, but mm-hmm. where people can meet their credentials for high school, but it's all in an outdoor setting.
Oh, wow.
And something like that's so adaptive. Like, not everybody can sit in a classroom. Not everybody can focus for, you know, however long a school day is these days, like 7 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work for everybody. And the curriculum doesn't work for everybody. And so if you're adaptive to the person, like the individual, like maybe their outcomes can be better, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they might have this condition that's impairing or this disorder that can be impairing, but there's like a really important environmental piece that can be changed, modified
for sure.
to improve the outcomes.
Of course, yeah. So I guess like trying to sum up what I'm understanding from your research, you're looking at a possible trend between people with ADHD and dementia, like who develop dementia later on, but not stigmatizing like the ADHD portion of this, but by acknowledging that people with ADHD can be affected by these social determinants that make it more likely in some ways for dementia, but not because they have ADHD, but because of the way that society worked, especially older populations back then.
Totally.
Untreated people with ADHD who were perhaps even isolated further because they were, as you mentioned, like outcast in some ways from larger, normal, I'm doing air quotes, social situations, social groups.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. So like today, you know, there's a lot more understanding, I think, about ADHD. There's more adaptation for those individuals. Yeah, our whole like society is kind of coming along with its understanding and awareness of mental health conditions and all that stuff. But like back then, it was a different environment. And so, yeah, it's that environmental piece that I'm interested in because it can be modified. And so if it can be modified, things can be better. And it's not like I know so many people with ADHD who are like in my program who are like really doing incredible work and who are really flourishing and, you know, they got it going on. And that can be the case for more people. That is the case for a lot of people with ADHD. And so I like that because it's kind of, it taps into that resilience. Like, even though you have this adversity, there's these positive outcomes that could come out of it. So that's cool.
It's a really optimistic thesis.
I'm hoping. I haven't seen the data yet.
But I don't know. I think especially with health and with even psychology, it feels like sometimes research can be maybe depressing isn't the right word, but can feel heavy and difficult. But this sounds like a really optimistic project, and it definitely changed my opinion in terms of like looking at cognitive health from a different standpoint, like not from a purely biological standpoint, not from like a purely genetic standpoint, but looking at a specific case of people who have environmental difficulties, like you mentioned, and looking at how that affects cognitive health. I think that's amazing. Yeah, it's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, like this semester, the goal is to do all of my data.
Yeah.
My goal is to defend first week of August. So I'm just working towards that.
Yeah, best of luck.
Thank you.
I think it sounds great. If I was on your panel, I would be super interested. Maybe I'll try and come to the defense. You mentioned your peers a little bit. I'm just curious about the work of your peers and if they've influenced your own research and how maybe other scholars in your field have also influenced the way that you look at your own research or the way you research or things like that.
Yeah, so some of my peers are also working in the space of prevention. And so I draw inspiration from them because they're looking at kind of like the same idea, but in different populations. So I have one friend looking at it in people who have, who are exhibiting non-suicidal self-injury. And so comparing notes and ideas, it's nice to have a cohort of people who are also thinking along the same lines as you. We all have very developmental perspectives, which means that we like to consider all of the interactions that are happening between the person and the people around them and the environments that they live in and the point in time that we're in and how all of these different factors come together to make the person who they are, or like how we see them, how we can measure them. And so my peers, you know, inspire me in that way. And they're also just all such hardworking people that always pushes me to strive and try a little harder because, you know, it's inspiring to see people immersed in work and kind of like, you know, like when you see somebody in that state of flow, you're like, oh yeah, they're really doing some work right now. And that inspires me. And my peers are really disciplined people. And so it brings the best out of me.
Yeah. I feel the exact same way. Like seeing the people around me excel or just even just put in the effort makes me want to put in the effort.
Totally.
Just because it just, you want to be at the same level as the people you're around, especially if there are people that are your friends and they're spending a lot of time with them. You could be spending up to like 2-3 years with them.
Totally.
So you want to see each other succeed. And you also don't want to let them down, right? Because they want to see you succeed too.
Yeah. Right? So we often collaborate. I mean, there's a lot of collaborations that go on, not just in my cohort, but across cohorts. And there's kind of a sense of accountability with that. A lot of grad school is like working on projects.
Yes.
As opposed to undergrad. Like undergrad was a lot of just like studying, taking exams, just like checking off the boxes, like this assignment's due, you know, that exam has to be done then.
For sure.
But in grad school, it's just completely different. And I did well with the undergrad model, but the grad school model is like way better.
Yeah.
You know, it's you collaborate on projects. It's a lot of just like discussion based. A lot of my classes have been seminar style where, you know, you're asked to read and then you come to class with your ideas and you just talk and you talk about the methods and all of these pieces that you might not have thought of. But it by sharing ideas, you kind of you learn a lot. So yeah, I'm really lucky to be around such productive people.
For sure.
Yeah.
Totally. Oh, that's amazing. What do you think is a common misconception about your field or your research? You could talk about psychology, you could talk about health.
I think one misconception is that growing old is no fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like that it's inevitably terrible and that you're just going to end up being disabled. And I think that's a misconception. I don't think that that's necessary. I don't think that that needs to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then you see this news story of a 100-year-old canoeing or something, you know?
True, yeah.
And I think that could be, or even the that Netflix documentary that came out that everybody was talking about for a while, The Blue Zones.
Oh, I don't know about that one.
Oh, so like there's this phenomenon across the world. I think there's maybe 7 different blue zones, and they're called blue zones. I think that was just a weird reason why it was called blue zones.
Okay.
But what it's referring to is like these little areas, regions across the world where people seem to grow old and stay very healthy more often than not. So like people living to 100 years old and they're like very healthy, they're cognitively very healthy, they're physically healthy. And it's just, it's cool. It's really cool. But it just speaks to like the fact that that can be the case for everybody. It's like lifestyle. A lot of it is lifestyle. Like these people are physically active. They eat a good diet. They're social. They have community connections and relationships that keep them healthy. And so I think that people growing old and staying healthy all the way to the end of their life is a possibility for everybody. And I often hear people say or anticipate their older age as if it's going to be something that
they're dreading.
Yeah, they're dreading, yeah. You know, like, oh, once the golden years are over, you know, it's all downhill from even like when you turn 25, it's like, oh, it's all downhill from there. And
yeah,
it's like, oh,
sure.
No, come on.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
I mean, also, I think growing up now and being this age that we are now and looking at the future, it's a lot more optimistic in some ways, I think, too, than people 50 years ago, you know,
like, yeah,
because of the cognitive health stuff, too, but also healthcare for us and like knowing more about our bodies,
yeah,
and knowing more about what can keep us healthy for longer. But now also keeping an eye on our cognitive health and knowing what can make our brains healthy for longer, too, as opposed to just our bodies. I have a kind of an interesting question. You may not know anything about this,
but, okay,
just to spring something on you, because you mentioned these blue zones. I grew up in Hong Kong.
Okay.
So Hong Kong, as of right now, has the highest average lifespan in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It is. It's Hong Kong, I think Macau, and then Japan. I think those are the top three. It changes. Different stats or whatever,
yeah,
but they're all very high, like up in the high 80s. Was there any like research into these, like what was the reasoning for these blue zones? Like you kind of mentioned like more of these social determinants, very social, active lifestyles, things like that.
Yeah, I think I didn't watch the documentary, but I've seen other, I've seen a similar documentary to it. And yeah, I think that basically what they're getting at is like that these people live very healthy lives,
mm-hmm,
and that's contributing to their lifespan. I think that there's a risk that people might think that they have to live there to live,
yeah,
to grow old.
That's kind of what I've thought too.
Yeah.
Like it's not the place. It's,
yeah,
not the geographical location.
Yeah.
It's the social, it's the culture maybe in these places too, right?
Yeah. It's the culture. It's like, maybe it has something to do with geography too. Like, you know, like we're, like I said earlier, like you or I, like we're just like a product of everything that's,
totally,
around us,
for
right?
Sure.
Like if it's like altitude, like maybe that makes a difference.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe.
But I think pollution has a big part to play in our longevity and our,
yeah,
health. And a lot of the blue zones are like pretty low density population areas,
sure,
where there isn't a lot of like exhaust from like trucks and cars and all that kind of stuff. But that's not the only thing, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I was so surprised about Hong Kong.
Like, yeah, this has been a that surprised me too.
Hong Kong is so dense.
And yeah. It's
like, there's like a decent amount of pollution. Like the air quality in there is always pretty bad.
No, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. The social determinants must be a big thing there too, because I feel like Hong Kong people, family is such a big thing. Like keeping close social connections is a big thing. I think food is probably also part of it too. Like, like keeping your body healthy in some ways too. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I never really thought about like how the social aspect of Hong Kong people would affect their lifespan.
Yeah, I wonder what, I mean, I wonder if somebody's like looked into that.
Yeah, or, I have no idea.
Maybe that's really interesting.
Yeah. And same with Japan. Like Japan has like rural areas, but also very dense cities. So
yeah.
Super interesting.
Yeah. I don't know what Okinawa looks like, but that's one of the blue zones in Japan. I don't know what the density, population density looks like there.
That's a lower, I think it's more of a rural region.
Rural region,
but
yeah.
But still.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I think it's a powerful concept just to think that, like, yeah, it's like the environment that we're in that can really improve our health span and our lifespan. And that's, some of that is in our control. Mm-hmm. Some of it isn't. But the stuff that is, like, you know, we might as well try to exercise that to, yeah.
Yeah, I guess what I've learned from today, at least, is that I guess I've always thought about lifespan and longevity as mostly due to keeping your body healthy, eating good food, and just like staying healthy, like keeping the physical portion of your body healthy. Of course, I've heard, like I mentioned before, like you have to stay social to stay alive. Like humans are social beings.
Yeah.
But I thought that was more of just like a making you feel better kind of thing. But I never really thought about these social determinants and how important they are and how much of our lives are extended and also just like kept alive, not just surviving, right? Like over so many years.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think a lot of people right now, a lot of people live like the last, I don't know, like decade, two decades of their life in some sort of like with some sort of disability. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, that, you know, like people might have with attention paid to like diet and like exercise is a, I think a really important one too. Like kind of shortening that disability span, yeah, is of interest to me for sure.
So you're defending hopefully in August. That's kind of the goal. And you have this podcast kind of on the way.
Yep.
What do you think is next after your defense?
That's a good question. I'm going to take a holiday.
Amazing.
Yeah. But after that, I'm looking towards doing a PhD.
Okay. Yeah.
I need to know a bit more about what that would look like and what I want to commit myself to in terms of research.
For sure.
Something that I want to explore with the podcast for myself and for others is career options after grad school. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that isn't always that obvious, especially when you're in like a research-based program, especially in psychology, as opposed to the clinical program. Like by the end of the clinical program, you know you'll be a clinician or you'll be a certified clinician. You could also be a researcher if you want, but you have a career that's waiting for you at the end. Whereas with research, there's a lot of different avenues that aren't all that evident. And so, yeah, I'm looking towards doing a PhD. Not sure what I want to study yet, but yeah, I want to explore with my podcast like what career paths there are after that. Because like I said, I'm really interested in this prevention stuff. So something along those lines would be, I think, a really rewarding career. But yeah, understanding what that could be still yet to be determined, I guess. Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe your podcast blows up.
Yeah. So, maybe that's my thing.
That's the career path.
Yeah.
It could be. People do that. That's
totally.
Like, that's like their whole lives these days.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Tara, for being on the podcast. Is there anything else you want to say to anybody listening or what's the title of, do you have a title for the podcast?
I was going to plug in the title
Sure.
It's called The Gradcast.
The Gradcast.
Yeah. And it's in partnership with CFUV. So it will be on their like streaming platforms. But yeah, the Gradcast.
Amazing. Awesome. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks again to Tara. I invited Tara on the show because I wanted to hear a little bit more about her own podcast premiering soon on CFUV. And I'm so glad I did because I feel like I've learned a lot more about cognitive health, especially thinking about my own cognitive health and the social determinants that may be affecting it in my day-to-day life. Keep an eye out for the Gradcast coming soon. Thanks for tuning in. This has been Beyond the Jargon on CFUV 101.9 FM, and I hope you'll tune into our next episode. Once again, my name is Sam Kaiser. Thanks very much for listening.